Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to this morning's study session for the Mesa City Council for Thursday, April 21st, 2011. Councilmember Glover, you there?
I'm here, Mayor.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thanks for being there. As you can see, we're short on numbers physically here, but we have Councilmember Glover on the phone, and we'd like to excuse the Vice Mayor and Councilmembers Kavanaugh and Higgins, who are all three out of town and were unable to join us by phone. But they are here in spirit, and that's a scary thought. So we'll go right ahead. The first item on the agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on solid waste management budget issues. Oh, excuse me. We've got a change?
No. It's just a slight. It's on the agenda. Just we have Candace kind of do an introduction, and then we'll have each department come up. I think it's listed as the second item on the agenda.
It's included in with the water resources. It says water resource budget issues and utility rate recommendations.
Okay.
We'll do that first, and then we'll bring solid waste, and then we'll bring the different departments.
What if I don't want to do it first?
Then we'll do it your way.
At your discretion.
We'll do it first. I made an executive decision. We'll do it first.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Go ahead, Candace.
Okay. Good morning, Mayor and Council. What we'd like to do this morning is just give you kind of an overview of the process that we use. The departments that you're going to hear from this morning are within our enterprise area. They're also the ones that have our utility rate recommendations that we go through each year. So I just want to give you a quick overview. Oh, if the buttons would work. I'm sorry, but my screen is frozen.
See, that's what happens when you go out of
line. Yeah. I know when you go
that's
out of order.
That's what happens when you go out of line. I could have warned you about that.
Okay. Excuse me. So while we work on this, I'll just let you know, give you an overview. You probably have it in front of you if you have it on Legistar anyway. Each one of our utilities is operated as a separate business center. Debt service, both existing and future, is estimated based on the capital improvement program, and it's included in our financial model. Our total transfer amount from the enterprise fund remains the same each year. This is something that was set by a previous council, and that has remained constant in all of our financial models when we look at these particular enterprises. The recommended rate adjustments are smoothed year by year. So when we look over the course of a 3-year or a 5-year window, we look at our expenses and our estimated expenses and our estimated revenues, and we project the rate increases we would need, and we try to smooth those over time. So if there's a peak in expenses, we don't want a peak in our recommended rates.
So what you're really saying is we're on a multi-year rate window is basically
correct.
We don't show up every year and say, my goodness, what rate are we going to need this year, and then we go scrambling to figure out what we need. We've tried to project out multiple years as to what that rate will be, and we know a lot of, you know, we know debt service for the most
part.
We have a pretty good idea of what it costs us, and we anticipate demand, and we can do that. Well, we have been able to do that until just recently. Pretty consistently, because people's habits have been fairly consistent over the last few years, and we have a body of knowledge. Is that what you're saying?
So we try to
project out, and then we plan accordingly based on those multiple year windows.
That's correct, Mayor.
Okay.
We're always looking behind us at the history and forward into at least a 3-year, 5-year, 8-year window of what our demands are going to
be.
So
we have a good idea as to what we're going to charge two years from now. We have a number in mind.
We have a number in mind,
yeah,
based on the conditions today.
Right. And if the conditions change
today,
and if the things shift, then we can adjust that.
That's
but we're not scrambling to figure out what the rate's going to be on an annual basis. I want to make that clear, because I think there's some people, and you know, I can understand why, that somehow believe that we sit back and wait to see what money we need, and then we set rates. And actually what we've done is we're trying, and this is not really anything we put in. This was put in before I got in office and before Alex and Dave got in office. What I believe is a very disciplined financial approach, which is to try and project out. And so there is, like you said, consistency. There is not volatility. People can see what they're going to be paying, and the city can budget accordingly, and therefore we live within our means. That's the discipline that hopefully we've undertaken. And like I said, I'm just grateful that was put in place, and so this council has decided to continue with that, and the staff's done a great job of helping us out. And then we get into situations where we have unforeseen changes.
Correct.
Okay, go ahead.
And we'll be discussing those a little bit later this morning.
Yeah, that was called a layup.
Yes.
Okay,
that was
a softball.
That's right. Yay. When we have had some significant factors that have contributed to the rate recommendations that we are making to you this year, some of those in our solid waste area, they've actually experienced some savings that area will talk to you about when they do their presentation. And then in water and wastewater, we've had some accounts, or while our accounts have been continuing to increase, that requires us to continue to build to maintain the infrastructure. Our consumption has drastically decreased over this time. And the consumption is what our rate model is based on. And so the variability in the consumption is the variability in our revenues. So that's a significant factor in what we're going to be coming to you this year for rate recommendations. These are the rate recommendations as proposed to the Audit and Finance Committee. And this is just a summary of what, when we came to you last year with our forecast, so the spring of 2010, these were the rates that we were forecasting for the fiscal year 11-12. This year, coming to you in the spring of 2011, these are our revised rate recommendations that were coming to you this year. And we'll get a little bit further into, as we go through each department, what's factoring into those particular rate recommendations.
Okay, so just to back up, because I want to make sure that I know the slide sort of speaks for itself, but just to state what it is. Once again, each of these departments operates individually.
Correct.
And are treated as a separate business unit. We do that so we can manage them effectively. The bill I get, and that every other ratepayer in the city of Mesa gets, though, is a consolidated bill. I mean, I get one bill that has a lump sum that's due from the city, and what I care about is that what's the check I cut total to the city of Mesa. And in my case, that's solid waste, gas, water, wastewater, which most people in the city it is, those four items. So I care what the combined total is, and because that's my total check. We have rates that are individual. We look at what you're saying here is we're looking at the combined total, though, and even though we have some ups and downs in the individual areas, the combined impact to a tax to a ratepayer is virtually zero.
Correct. The impact between our recommendation from last year and our recommendation this
right.
year to the average resident is the same.
And to the average ratepayer, to the average citizen who has a bill, the check they're going to cut every month based on this rate scenario is not significantly different from what we anticipated last year.
Correct.
Okay.
So that leans back to our multi-year model. So the model that we projected last year, this year's impact is total impact is no different than the model that we projected last year.
Okay.
It's just in different of the different components of those utilities. Oops. The one area that we do have some that we'll have some additional discussion on this morning is our water and wastewater areas. They are reliant on the variable component of their rate model, which is their consumption. And the majority of their cost is actually a fixed cost. As I mentioned earlier, our consumption over the last few years has dropped off dramatically. So as part of our rate recommendations, we are recommending to better stabilize the revenues by instituting a minimum charge for both water and wastewater. And again, when we go into the water and wastewater department, we'll talk about those specifically, what the recommendation is. This is our annual average homeowner survey charges. And this is the thing that we look at each year and how we benchmark ourselves against the other municipalities within the valley, what their current rate structure is. We take into account the rate structures in the other areas, as well as their property tax, both primary and secondary if they have one, their city sales tax as well. We combine those all together to do a comparison of if an average Mesa resident lived in one of the other municipalities, how much would they pay per year for the same services that they're receiving here. So if you go through this, where our current is today, the top one is their Mesa current rate, so as they sit today. And then the comparison to the other municipalities, you can see at this point that there are two municipalities that are below us, and the rest are above us at this point. The stars indicate those who have not taken any action on their 11-12 rates so far. So at the bottom, we have our proposed rate recommendations for utilities and where that would place us against the other municipalities in the valley.
So isn't this, so as it relates to Gilbert, Scottsdale, Tempe, and Glendale, this is an apples and oranges kind of a analysis, isn't it?
Right. It's, well, the Mesa current would be a direct comparison with where they sit today, but our proposed is correct. Our proposed means they are also going to have some proposed rate increases. We don't know what those are at this time. So that could change one where we sit within the comparison within the other cities.
Okay.
So just to give you an idea of where we are today and where we may be tomorrow, but we don't know the rate recommendations that those other cities are going to do over their budget process. And then just to give you an update on what our calendar is for the rate recommendation portion of our budget process, on May 16th, you'll be adopting a utility rate notice of intention. It's an intention to adjust the fees. At that point, we do not actually state what the fees are going to change to.
You know, could you get back?
I'm sorry.
Councilman Richens and I are having a sidebar conversation, which probably isn't good. What's that based on? I'm looking at your comparison between the cities.
Mm-hmm.
What's that based on? Because, you know, I look at our property tax, which we have no primary.
We have no primary.
I think the only other city that doesn't have a primary is Gilbert, right?
Correct.
But Gilbert has a secondary property tax that's huge.
That's correct.
What's that based on? Is that based on the proverbial $150,000 house?
Correct. It's actually based on an average home of $139,900.
What's the average sales price of a house in Gilbert?
And that's what we do is we take the average sale price, the average price of a Mesa home and Mesa services. So what their average
but that doesn't really work because there's not a $139,000 house is not the average house in Gilbert. The average sales price of a house in Gilbert is probably $239,000.
Yeah, $190,000 I thought I just heard as an adjusted. It was $212,000 down to $190,000.
$190,000.
I mean, look, we take that from the Maricopa County Assessor's Office.
What we're saying is, this isn't a huge point.
No, you can do it that way where you'd have to take each community's average and then apply.
Yeah, because what you're doing is you're presenting information that says that the average house homeowner pays this much, and they don't. Because the average homeowner in Gilbert doesn't live in a $139,000 house. They live in a $190,000 house. And their secondary property tax, which is $33, $40, whatever it is.
It's $1.15.
$1.15, mm-hmm. You know, is applied against a $190,000 house. In this calculation, you're applying against a $139,000 house.
That's correct. What we're in
so
your
what
correct.
You should do on these things is take the average
go, we
assessed
go back
value.
To the assessor and get the average.
We can.
We can go back and make that report.
And the only reason I do that is that these numbers get thrown back at us when we're out mm-hmm. and about, and they say, how is it that Gilbert pays less than we do, and I'm scratching my head because I think we do a pretty good job. And nothing against Gilbert. I mean, each city is unique. And the fact is, in Scottsdale, I know there's no way looking at their combined property tax rate because their average house price is probably $290,000. I don't know what it is, but it's up there. And so they're getting the same trash, they're getting the same water, they're getting the same this, but they have a tax rate that's based on assessed valuation that's much higher than what our citizens are. So I think what you need to do is when you look at this, you need to take that city's valuation.
Why don't we go revise this and we'll bring it back the next time? Okay.
Yeah,
you can do that.
Okay, thank you.
It gives them more apple to apple.
Yeah.
What this is doing is actually saying that particular resident who owns a house that's worth $139,900.
But you understand why that's not a good.
The point is.
Because, because we're
getting. In the community, your average homeowner is going to pay much more.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
you can
right.
Do that.
Yep. Okay. We can do that.
I just like to get more of the apples to apples. Okay. What a real homeowner is going to pay.
Sure.
Okay.
Not a problem.
Okay.
Then just go over the calendar. Like I said, May 16th, we're going to be adopting the utility rate notice of intention. Again, that is not associated with the actual rates, the adjustment to the rates themselves. It's just a public notice that we will be adjusting the rates and giving them a notice of when the public hearing would be for that one. June 6th is when we'd come back and actually introduce the rate ordinances. Those would have the recommended rates on those. June 27th is the adoption of those ordinances. And just to point out, June 27th is a new date from the previous presentations. That's the council meeting that was moved from June 20th to June 27th. And the effective dates for the rates would go in on August 1st is when these would be effective.
Okay.
Well, now what we're going to do is just kind of start through all our departments then.
Thank you.
morning, Mayor and Council members. My name is Willie Black. I'm the Solid Waste Director, and I'm here to give the update on the Solid Waste budget and department. Start out with this year's budget and our forecast. We're projecting our revenue to be a little bit higher than what was budgeted, our expenses lower than what was budgeted, which increases our net income. And I'll go into that a little bit later in the presentation about the reasons why that is. Looking back to last year's budget comparing to this year and going on to next year, one of the biggest things we had in 2009-10 was a reduction in our expenses. And what we did is we reduced the number of personnel by four. We reduced our landfill fees, and our net income rose based on a lot of those things. We maintained our transfer out at the $18,400,000 and reduced our FTEs from 132 down to 127 projected for next year. As far as revenue goes for solid waste, we're going to see an increase in revenue this year. Part of the increase in revenue this year is our recycling. The market is really good for recycling right now. Recycling is up 88.1% this year, and a lot of that is just basic supply and demand. The more people that stop reading the newspaper or stop getting it delivered to their homes and they're reading it online, the more demand there is for the product, so the price goes up. The other thing is our mobile home communities. We had a number of mobile home communities last year that opted to change their service. In the past, what they were doing was collecting the garbage on their own, and they were placing it in metal bins, and we would collect it. Now we've converted these mobile home parks to barrel service, and they've got recycling as well, and it's much more convenient for the customers, provides them better customer service, and also allows them to recycle. So those are the two big areas where we saw an increase in revenue. Some of our big expenses is equipment usage and fuel, and you can see our equipment usage is going down over the years. Some of the factors in that is our newer fleet of trucks. A lot of the trucks are under warranty, so a lot of the repairs are covered by warranty. And then again, we manage our routes throughout the year. And since 2007-08, we've actually reduced our miles by 200,000 miles driven. And, of course, miles relates to cost. Diesel, the price of diesel, of course, is a concern for us. And the average for this year for us has been so far $2.73 a gallon, although we're paying $3.55 at the pump now. It's one of the things we struggle with, and keeping in mind, we go through about 50,000 gallons of diesel a month. So we're trying to do everything we can to conserve out there and keep our costs down for our customers. Trash tonnage. You can see how our trash tonnage continues to decline. This is all related to the economy, not only the vacant homes, but we're still seeing a reduction in consumer spending. Our average pounds per barrel has decreased 7.8% over the last couple of years, while recycling is down 10.2%. And you think that might affect our diversion rate, and diversion meaning the material that we're able to have the customer divert out of the trash barrel into the blue barrel, but our diversion rate has actually went up in the blue barrels. In 2006-07, our blue barrel diversion rate was 21.9%, and today we're at 23.3%. So our customers are still doing a good job with recycling. It's just all related basically to the economy and not spending money.
I'm sorry, I got to get. So trash could be, is that a leading indicator or a trailing indicator? Probably a trailing indicator.
Actually, Willie represents the crack team of our forecasting division and has been very successful at predicting for us.
Predicting things. Yeah. No, that's interesting. You wouldn't think about that, but people buy less and they throw less away. I don't think they're hoarding, are they? Maybe they are.
Not everybody.
That's interesting.
No, it really does, and it's amazing that trend, how it follows the economy.
Huh. Okay.
March was our first month in a long time that we saw an increase in trash tonnage. Although it was only 1.8 tons that we saw an increase, we also saw an increase in recyclables, and we're hoping that's a sign of the economy turning around. The first couple of weeks in April, we're also seeing an increase on the trash side, and we're seeing it for the first time on our commercial side as well. So hopefully that's a good sign that things are going to start turning around. Taking a look at the number of homes serviced, this is a three-year comparison that we use, the green line being this year here. You can see in the summertime is our low time. As it climbs up in late October and we peak in March, that's the mobile home communities. As the mobile home parks fill up with our winter visitors, then it declines back down again. Most of our routes were built off of 90% set-out rate, meaning for the customers paying, 90% of them are setting their trash barrels out, and we're seeing the set-out rate decline, and it's got to do with the vacant homes that are out there. We have an advantage with the vacant homes that as long as the bank's not cleaning up the property and placing the barrels out or the neighbors aren't borrowing the barrels, we're not picking up anything, so we're able to reduce the size of our routes, and that's how we're able to save on the personnel side, the trash tonnage side, and the equipment side.
So we basically have the opposite effect that we do in other areas like water.
Correct.
Because you're basically variable costs, the amount you pick up, other than once you buy the trucks and everything.
Well, again, if you go back,
it's a variable cost driven, whereas water, it's more of a fixed cost driven type
right.
thing. Because
so his rate is fixed.
Related. Yeah.
His rate is fixed, and even though, and that's the significant difference is, and he showed his revenues a couple slides back, but because his rate is fixed, and the number of accounts remains pretty much the same, he collects the same amount of revenue regardless of the trash set out.
Yeah.
And that makes a big difference. And you're right, that's a significant comparison when we're going to talk about water, where essentially the same number of accounts are active, but because of consumption dropping, and it's a consumption-based fee, there's a much difference in the revenue.
Yeah. Just real question. You're on that slide right there. The looks like there's about a 10,000 account difference between off peak or off season and the winter peak. Now on the mobile home parks, how many of them have, you know, what would you call it?
Mass.
Individual pickup versus a mass versus what's the?
You have that talk about. You have an example where you have like a.
The bin
for the whole park,
correct.
Yeah.
Correct. We have some parks that have multiple metal bins.
Right.
They might have five bins where the park picks up the material and takes.
And those would only be counted as each of those bins is counted the same as a home or a separate pickup or an account.
No, we're not counting that in this. This
okay,
is just
so
what
those
the
aren't
residential
included.
Side.
No. So on individual pickups, you still see about a 10,000 home pickup in the winter versus the summer.
Correct.
And that does not include your RV parks. Or your mobile home parks, where there's a bin pickup rather than individual unit pickup.
The mobile home and RV parks I consider as being the same. We're calling them a home,
okay.
And we go to about 4,000 to 5,000 in the summertime is what we're picking up, and we peak at about 13,000 in the wintertime.
But that doesn't include those that have consolidated like bins.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Correct.
Now, I mean, just off the top of your head, how many do you go into the actual RV and pick up individual units, and how many have bin? What's the split on that? I know that's a tough question because you don't have it right in front of you.
I honestly couldn't tell you. We're getting more and more of them. We're moving in that direction. Because
of the individual pickup?
Correct.
Okay.
When we went from manual collection to automated collection, a lot of the parks wanted to go into the trash business themselves and collect the material, make it more convenient. But what they found, they started doing it with volunteers. And we know what happens with volunteers is it doesn't work. So then you have to start paying people to do it. You've got the workman's comp claims. You've got the problems with people showing up. This is the most convenient way for them to
because you can't have people
service.
Walking 50 or 100 yards to do their own
correct
garbage, so we can pick it up in a bin,
correct?
Especially in that
demographic,
that clientele, yeah.
And our goal is to move more parks to that, as long as they're willing to do that.
Gotcha.
These are all parks that came to us asking us to change the service.
Okay.
The next example for us is personal services. I talked about we've reduced the number of employees. Also, what we've done is we manage our vacant positions. Is we only fill a vacant position when we need to fill it, and we manage our overtime. This year, we're expecting, so far this year, we've saved $375,000 in personnel costs, and we're expecting by the end of the year, we'll have saved $500,000. As far as our rate increase history, the last rate increase we've had in solid waste was 08-09, and that was 3.2%. The last 2 years, no rate increase, and we're recommending no rate increase again for this year. As part of our monthly taking back and looking at auditing our services, what we do is we do a benchmark measuring our service against private service to see how efficient and how effective it is for Mesa to keep the service in-house. We've used a couple of different benchmarks before. We've used the City of Phoenix, and our problem with using the City of Phoenix now is they're collecting all of the garbage in Phoenix, and we can't use their numbers because obviously Phoenix isn't going to come over and do business in Mesa. We've used the City of Goodyear before. They were at $1,432 a home. It includes landfill cost and recycling revenue the hauler keeps. Not really a good comparison for us. The town of Queen Creek, another small community, they're paying $90.
Wait a second. If you put that on this slide, it's a real good comparison for us. It may not be a reasonable one, but it looks good on the slide. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's okay. The town of Queen Creek at $987 per home includes landfill fees. Again, not another good comparison for us. We wanted something that was more competitive and realistic. The city of Chandler has bid their services out for some time now, and Waste Management just won the bid again this last year. Waste Management is the $598 a home, and our cost comparison with them for the second quarter is $569 a home. So we're doing a good job. In the third quarter, we're expecting that number to go down. What happens in the third quarter, that's our busiest time. And in the garbage business, the closer your accounts are together, the more money you make, the more efficient you can be. We're expecting that number to drop in the 550 range. So we keep monitoring that, making sure that Mesa is getting the best service available for the customers. And just so that you know, the last area that Phoenix won, Republic Services bid it at $722 a home, Waste Management bid it at $924 a home, and City of Phoenix did it at bid $652 a home.
So we ought to pass some legislation that says the city
Let's go bid on the City of Phoenix. maybe we do like that legislation. We'll go pick their garbage up.
Swap, you know, or something, yeah.
By the way, Gary and Karen, that was a joke, okay? that was not an actual thing.
As far as our landfill...
Not a very funny joke, but it was a joke.
As far as our landfill and disposal update, we continue with our contract negotiations with the Salt River, Pima, Maricopa, and Indian community. Our current contract is due to expire in 2015. The extension we're working on will take us to 2020, and with an extension possibility of 2025 and 2030. And the Salt River Landfill currently does an annual report on airspace, and airspace is measured in cubic yards, and then you base it off of how much previous years you've put into the facility and how much is going out into what you're projecting for the future. And they're at the capacity right now. They're looking to go to 2022. As technology increases in the landfill business, that'll probably easily go to 2025 and possibly into the 2030. Waste Management, we currently have a contract with. We use two of their facilities, the Sky Harbor Transfer Station over in Phoenix, and we use the Santan Transfer Station in the East Valley here. We've got another two-year extension on that contract, and this is the contract where our residents are allowed to use the disposal site as well for our landfill program. They can use this and the Salt River Landfill. The other contractor we use is Republic Services. Republic Services has the AJ Landfill out in Apache Junction, and they've got the Mesa Transfer Station off of Mountain Road. We use both of those facilities, and the AJ Landfill still is estimating 13 to 15 years of life left in it. And after that, the Republic Services has another landfill that's projected to have 300 years of life left in it. So we've got a lot of opportunity for our trash to go places. And then just a quick update on accomplishments and goals. Our recycling and outreach area has been very busy. We continue our partnership with Mesa Public Schools. We signed the intergovernmental agreement with Mesa Public Schools this last year where we're going to be providing service to them for the next 5 years. Again, our Earth Day plastic bag challenge, which netted more plastic bags than we ever dreamed of. And it's also getting the education of what to do with the plastic bags. This year, we created an activity book that we in honor of Earth Day, and most of the schools got that book this week. And what we did when we went out looking for a book, we tried to find a book that related to our programs, and we couldn't find anything. So what we did is we did it in-house. And I've got a sample for each one of you. The artwork was done by one of our solid waste equipment operators, Dave Grimm, so we're really proud of the work that he did and the product that was turned out with that. This next summer, we're going to be working on classroom presentations to go back into the classroom. Now that we've got blue barrels in most all of the schools, the next thing to do is get back into the classroom for presentations. We continue our scouting partnership with the Boy Scouts, where they do our outreach every November for America Recycles Day, and they put the brochures on recycling on each one of the single-family homes in Mesa. We're looking at partnering with them for a Boy Scout patch this year to do some education on recycling. We continue our partnership with the Girl Scouts. We're in our second year of the Girl Scout partnership where we do recycling education and they actually earn a patch. We updated our Mesa Recycles video and logo this last year and updated our website as well. Any questions?
Councilmember Finter.
Just want you to know I've always been really impressed with the solid waste group, and even when there was some talk of, hey, let's challenge it at a privatization kind of a model, you always step up. It's been really nice. The feedback I get from the community is really positive. One idea that's come through the council office, and maybe we'll make it through IMESA, is having collection cans all on one side of one road. And I know there's some pros and cons to that. Is that something that you've even looked at initially, or, you know, I know you probably have heard about it too, but.
We've, Councilmember Fincher, we've actually implemented that in all of the mobile home communities.
Okay.
We
okay.
do the one-sided service in all of them. And we're looking at it for townhouses and communities such as that. We've looked at some regular single-family neighborhoods, and because of the backtracking we have to do, it doesn't work in all areas. That's one of our goals for this year, is to take a look at where we can implement it at. And we want to implement where the community wants it implemented at. And there's a savings on the asphalt with the number of times we're passing through.
And the big truck, huh? So good. So you're looking into it. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Councilmember Glover.
Unmute. Well, I don't have any questions, but thank you, Mayor.
Good.
I'm still here.
Okay.
Don't worry.
You had to get off mute.
If you leave, don't tell us.
Don't worry. I just...
All right, thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Willie.
Thank you.
Okay, the next item is water resources.
Good morning, Mayor, Council members. You know me, Catherine Sorensen, Water Resources Department Director. To my left is Alicia Solano. She is our Deputy Director for Water Enterprise Services. And Candace is going to stay up here with us as well. So you can lob questions and comments in this general direction, and one of us will attempt to answer them. I want to start out with, are we ready to go on that? Let's go. I want to start out with some highlights, because there's going to be only a little good news in this presentation. So I want to start out with that. But the good news is that we there's a comparison, a financial comparison of utilities across the country that's done by the Association of Metropolitan Water Agencies every year. Those results recently came out, and I'm proud to say that we compared very favorably. Our O&M costs per capita were 30% lower than the next lowest respondent in the Valley. We were half as much as some of the other Valley respondents. Again, about 30% lower than the national median. And also our debt service and cash capital costs were about 30% lower than the next lowest local respondent and about 24% lower than the national median. I think that's good, and we actually later got some data from some local cities that didn't respond to the survey, and there again, we were very low compared to them, more than 30%. So I hope that these numbers show you that the Water Resources Department is an efficient and cost-effective enterprise, and also that we are conservative with our capital spending. Okay, I want to give you a quick financial overview of the water utility. You'll notice that we've managed to reduce direct costs each year for the last couple of years, so that's good. Highlighted, though, on the slide is the jump in debt service that we're going to see next year, and we're going to be talking more about that later in the presentation. Also, please note here that the ending fund balance is projected to drop precipitously low in the water utility. In the wastewater utility, a similar but slightly different picture. Again, here we've been able to cut costs year over year. And here again, debt service is rising. However, you'll notice that the projection for the ending fund balance is much better. We're looking at combining the two ending fund balances between the two programs to kind of bolster the water utility ending fund balance. In fiscal year 11-12, we proposed several budget reductions. You can see them here. Two things of note. First, Jake West, who I think is in the audience or is supposed to be. You want to raise your hand? He's raising his hand back there. I want to give him some credit. He really took to task this year reducing overtime, and he did a great job. And so we've seen a reduction in our overtime of about half this last year, and I want to give him the credit for that. Also, I want you to notice that we're really starting to dig deep in these cuts. You'll notice right on the first item on the top of the list is arsenic remediation. What we did is we said, okay, we're gonna give up on Falcon Well number 15. We're not going to remediate for arsenic. We're just going to let that well go for the time being. We can go back in the future and remediate and put it back into our distribution system. But these are the kinds of...
Let's be clear. We're not going to take water from that well.
No, we can if we remediate the arsenic. What we've done...
But since we're not going to remediate the arsenic, we're not... It's not that we're pumping water into the system...
We're not using the well right now.
Okay, that's what I make sure, because the way it came out, it sounded like we're just not going to remediate arsenic.
No, yeah.
That's not a good headline we want.
Why would that be a problem? No.
Since in order to use the well, we would have to remediate the arsenic,
we are
not
using the well. Correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Mayor.
Councilman Fenter.
Yeah.
And that arsenic is naturally occurring?
It is naturally occurring.
And we've worked with the EPA challenges where they've increased the regulation along those points, and there's a great debate about that, but it is an unfunded mandate to us to try and deal with.
Correct.
Okay.
And when we say it naturally, arsenic just exists.
Yeah. Yes.
It's in the dirt.
In the dirt.
It's in your backyard.
Yes, it is.
On varying levels. So
yes.
This is not some chemical... Superfund site that some company dumped things out. This is just
this is naturally occurring, and it's the same throughout the valley.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to give you an example of these are the kind of cuts that we're making at this point. You've heard me get up on my soapbox and talk about how important it is to have redundancy in our wells. Well, okay, we're giving up a little redundancy here. We think it's still a good choice. Again, when we need that well in the future, we'll go back, remove the arsenic, and then pump the well back into the distribution system. But for now, We're just giving up on that redundancy.
Well, we don't have to have it. So what you're saying is that we'll give up some on the redundancy, but we'll save over $500,000 by taking that well out of service.
Correct.
Okay.
So I'm going to start in some of the bad news now. Unfortunately, running an infrastructure-intensive utility is an expensive proposition. So here's a list of some of the items that we had to add back into the budget. And you'll notice from the previous slide, we cut about $1.4 million from the budget, but you'll notice on this slide, we have to add about $1 million back in for various projects. But on the topic of reducing costs, please note also that we have delayed about $100 million in capital projects. Most of that comes in the delay of the third and final surface water treatment plant down at Signal Butte and Elliott and the associated transmission lines. But also we have pushed out some of the replacement of our aging infrastructure a couple of years. And I wanted to also note that, this last year, and I talked a little bit about this at our last session, but this last year we really created a new process to vet and continually evaluate our capital program and priorities. Part of this process involved inundating and torturing Chris on a regular basis with extreme levels of detail. But part of it also was looking at, are there ways that we
Wait, the torturing of Chris, is that part of the good news or the bad news?
Well, depends on your perspective. But part of that was looking at each and every project and going, is there a better, cheaper, more efficient way that we can still provide redundancy and provide for future growth? And it's easy enough for me to sit here and say, that's what we did. But let me give you a concrete example of that. Susan Miller talked to you last year about disinfectant byproduct regulations that are coming down from the federal government. And is Susan here? Can she raise her hand if she is? She was out at the plant this morning, so I don't know if she's made it here. But she deserves the credit for this. She talked to you last year about the Kool-Aid. I don't know if you remember the Kool-Aid conversation. But other cities have had to spend tens of millions, and I'm not exaggerating here, even hundreds of millions of dollars for disinfectant byproduct removal in their distribution systems. Susan really focused on using our expertise in-house. Using our engineers in-house and using technological innovations, and we think that the total bill for disinfectant byproduct removal in our distribution system is going to be about $3 million, a far cry from what other cities are spending for this. So just to give you an example of how we really are scrutinizing these projects and looking at them and making sure we're getting the best value we possibly can. We also make sure that they line up with city priorities, and we coordinate with the gas and transportation divisions so that when we have to go in and cut pavement, we're all doing it at once, and it's more efficient.
Councilman Finley.
Along those lines, Council, about a year ago, I think, authorized a new program to help alleviate some of those multiple impacts on different utilities hitting the streets and underground. How's that going?
Well, I think well. I mean, Dan and Frank and I and Beth, we all sit and coordinate our capital projects together and make sure that if anyone's going to be in a particular area, that we're only there once, and our goal is to only be there once in 5 years.
Yeah, I don't know. As much as it is coordinating internally, I think the key was, too, is the external.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The software we
purchased. Gotcha. I'm
right.
Sorry.
And being able to identify who's in and making sure we share with the SRPs and the Quest and the Coxes so that when we're going into an area, if there's any work or anything we can do jointly together, let them know ahead of time so we're not going in doing all our work, putting the street down, and then somebody else comes in and cuts it up. Now, that could still happen. SRP still exercises its sovereign immunity from our rules, but we try to coordinate with them to try to make that happen.
And you'll notice also that we are really working on managing our operating costs. You can imagine electricity, chemicals, water commodities, they have all increased tremendously over the last few years, but we've managed to keep our increases in our operating costs to a minimum. I'm going to sidestep here for a minute and talk to you about the new legislation that just came down. Our state legislators didn't want to raise taxes, but they didn't have enough money to fund their own government programs. So what they did is they decided that we, the cities, have to fund some of their programs, and they pushed the cost of running the Arizona Department of Water Resources down onto the cities. So every city in Arizona has to participate, and it's divvied out by population. Mesa's share is a little over $600,000 a year, and that's going to impact our customers about 37 cents per account per month. And what we would propose is that that actually be a line item on our utility bill so that our customers are quite clear about where this cost comes from and how it got pushed down to us.
Along those lines, on the line item, also ADEQ, didn't we have some other environmental costs that we... So it'd be nice to see how that really pencils, because there's quite a few environmental costs pushed to us and how that's captured
yeah.
on the bill.
And in fact, thank you, Councilmember Finter. And in fact, I'm sorry, in our budget additions, we kind of lumped it in with miscellaneous. But yeah, the environmental permits from both the county and the state are now much, much more expensive than they were in the past. That's one of the ways that they're passing on their cost to us as well. So a quick that would be my preference, yes. So quick overview of the water program for fiscal year 910. That's the last year for which we have, full numbers. You'll notice the water utility made about $105 million in revenues. Most of that's rate revenue. And that goes to our conversation about how dependent we are on our consumption. About $10 million in other income, that's interest on investment, impact fees, other things. But unfortunately, about $110 million in expenses. Right off the top comes a general transfer. That's $47 million. About $43 million in O&M and cash capital. And another $20 million in debt service. So we experienced a net operating loss of $5 million. We're projecting a net operating loss this year of about $6 million.
Okay, well, let's be careful how you throw around accounting terms.
Okay, sorry.
You really don't have a net operating loss, okay?
Okay.
Because I know you have demands on your cash that exceed the cash you're bringing in.
Mm-hmm.
A transfer to general fund may be an expense to you, but it's not an operating expense.
Right, I understand.
Okay, so let's be clear that you're not operating at a deficit from operations.
Yes, that's true.
Okay, well, I want to make sure because we're not losing money on our water operation.
No,
if we keep the there's certain things in here that are fixed. We're looking at the rate revenue. We're looking at $104 million in revenues. Those expenses. Oops, let's get back. The $19.8 million debt service, can't move that.
Mm-hmm.
O&M capital services, the O&M, you've moved it as best you can. The mm-hmm. capital, you could argue that, yeah, you could move some here or there. Most of those are not really discretionary because
right. We've already spent it. It's
you've already
ground.
Spent it. it's in the ground, or it's stuff that you've made the decision that we really need to replace this aging pipe, or else we're going to have higher costs next year.
Correct.
There is some discretionary in there.
Yeah.
And, of course, then the $47.2 million transfer is something the council set up in the budgeting.
Mm-hmm.
But that's basically taking that money, excess funds, or even digging into your reserves to transfer to cover general fund. That's
yeah.
how we've chosen to fund general fund items. That's
yeah.
not an operating loss at the water department.
Yeah, you're okay. correct, and you're right. What
for
we're
your
doing,
budgeting purposes, I understand that
yeah.
that's money that gets taken out of your accounts.
And,
I get that.
And you're right. What it is, it's a cash problem. So you're right. So we have to dig into our ending fund balance
right.
to meet all of those obligations.
It's a cash challenge
Absolutely.
For you, and I understand that. But I don't want someone to look at this and say, Mesa's losing money on their
it's
on their
right.
water.
It's a reduction in available resources.
Thank you. Okay, let's make sure, because net operating loss has a and
you're
this
right.
is the accounting.
Right. I mean, no, you're right.
This is the CPA in me coming out.
From a,
so I'm sorry.
From an operating perspective, there's
it's not an operating loss.
It's
yeah.
it's available resources.
You got it.
Yes,
okay.
Thank you, Mayor. But you might be wondering, hey, wait a minute, Catherine, I thought you said that you're going to save $6 million between the water and wastewater programs.
I was just going to ask that. Wait a minute,
yeah.
Dr. Sorensen.
Wait a minute. How does that work? What's going on? How
Could
is
explain,
it?
Explain, please.
Yes. How is it that we could be saving all this money, using these resources so efficiently, yet still we're going to have this cash problem? Well, we think we have some clues. Vacancies and foreclosures. And this is a slide from the Maricopa Association of Governments that shows you vacancy rates throughout the valley. And if you take a look at Mesa, you can see there's some pretty deep, dark colors there. So, and then this next slide.
Well, this isn't Doppler radar.
No.
No, it's not a monsoon. No.
Okay.
The next slide shows the same thing, but in a slightly different manner. But it shows that vacancy rates across Maricopa County are much higher this year than they have been in the last couple of years.
So, Mary,
the last big recession.
Yeah, we were talking Monday, I think, about vacancies throughout the valley, and we believe we have 136,000 water counts.
That's correct.
You know, if you even took this average of the vacancies, which I'm sure Mesa is at least average, if not maybe a little higher on vacancy, we're probably closer to that 10% number, maybe 12%.
Yeah, and I've heard numbers thrown around that there's upwards of 12,000 foreclosed homes
right.
in Mesa.
And I think at 136,000 accounts, it could
10%.
Be actually higher than that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's even at those estimates, that's still 9% of our utility accounts. That's a huge number.
Yes.
Of homes that are sitting there, but they're vacant. They have nobody in there.
Right.
Right.
And the good news is, and that certainly has impacted us during this past year and continues.
And by the way, that doesn't count multifamily vacancy rates either, who are on master meters.
Correct.
Who may not be using what they
Correct.
Were using.
Correct.
So
Correct.
Vacant apartments don't fit into that.
And then
which we've also seen an uptick in
right.
residents.
And this is only counting I believe it's only counting the residential side. Then you compound that with commercial.
Commercial.
Right.
And so there's obviously a significant impact on our consumption as a result of that.
I think we need to be careful in that, because at the first part, it almost sounded like the proverbial tug of war we're in, where we're running ads to asking people to conserve water, and on the other hand, we're saying,
mm-hmm.
gee, we're down because our consumption is down. And those are really two separate issues.
Mm-hmm.
We've factored in to our long-term estimates the fact that we want people to conserve.
Absolutely.
That's not what we're talking about
right.
here. And I think that's a message that can get mixed unless
right.
you really explain it.
We're talking about factors above and beyond that.
Yeah, we're talking about a shock to the system
yeah.
where we assume that if someone builds a house or has an apartment complex or there's a commercial, that we're going to experience historical vacancy rates.
Mm-hmm.
And those are not in the 10% range. Mm-hmm. Those are in the 1% to 2% range.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a little bit higher on commercial, maybe on apartments it's maybe even 4% or 5%, but it's minimal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now we're talking that we have homes, single-family homes, that are in the 10% range.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking businesses that are, you know, commercial and industrial. In some parks, it's in the, you know, 15 to 20, 30% range. So what we're saying is that the recession has created a new dynamic for us that is not anticipated and really has nothing to do with the per unit use of water. It has to do with the fact that we have units that are using no water. And that's not something you really planned for in the normal course of business, because thank heavens, it doesn't happen every year. We saw from your thing, the last big one was 1990. Believe me, I remember 1990 being in the business. That was a horrible year for real estate. And we probably, as it says right there, our vacancies were about as high. Other than that, you know, even if you look, some of the things are way down, are way up from where they're historically have been.
Absolutely.
So
if you could go to the next slide. So here's our concern. You know, our water system is built to provide service to houses that exist. The infrastructure to serve that house, which includes not just pipes, but pumps and wells, water treatment plants, water quality programs, and the cost to be ready to turn that water service on at a moment's notice should it be needed, those do not go away. Those costs do not go away when the house is vacant, nor does the need for police and fire protection go away when that house is vacant. We can't diminish infrastructure and other fixed costs and transfer less money out of the utility to pay for police and fire when those houses are empty. Those costs still exist and those needs still exist. So the vacancies create a volatile revenue stream for us. It's a shock to the system.
Councilmember Pinter?
And I would suggest that we actually have an increase in needs of services on code enforcement, the police department, others with those vacant homes.
Yeah. That's right.
And District 2 is a sea of houses. That's what District 2 is. And so, you know, we get a lot through the council office and a lot of feedback. And we've tried to give some tools to city employees as far as code enforcement. Whoever's got their name on that sign or managing that property is going to be held accountable. And but again, it has an overall impact, a grander impact, at least on these water services. And not to go too long, but had a visit on the phone yesterday with the business service part of water, talking about how we are not being reimbursed by HUD and Fannie Mae and others for water services, where people, realtors, other folks will go in and cut the locks on our meters,
Right. Actually
damage the meters, just trying to maintain those vacant homes. And then when it goes through the foreclosure process, we're left out of the reimbursement portion of that.
That's right.
And I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but that is a significant challenge, too, when we talk about
it
all
is.
This. So.
And currently, and you've heard me talk about this, but currently the revenue that this utility earns, it's highly dependent upon consumption. Those that consume more water pay more costs towards the utility and towards the general fund transfer, and that's a good thing. That is a good thing. Don't get me wrong. But it is also a risky thing, and it puts our revenues at risk when consumption declines precipitously, and that's exactly what's happened.
Well, historically, our water revenues have been our stable source of revenue. We talk about wanting to fund the city on stable sources of revenue, and the city decided long ago that water would represent our stable source of revenue.
Absolutely.
And this is the first time that we've really had this shock, because the situation is so unique.
And interestingly, Mayor, the city used to have a minimum charge that included the first 3,000 gallons of consumption back in the 80s. In the late 80s, the city decided to move away from that model and go towards more dependency on revenue collection in consumption because of the growth that we are experiencing over that period of time. And that made sense. You're really taking, when you load the revenue collection on the consumption during high growth periods, hey, that's a winning bet, right? Well, the problem is maybe that time has come and gone and we're faced with a shock to our system and we're trying to now reassess and recover from that. This slide shows you the picture of what we've experienced in the utility over the last couple of years. And you'll see that it's been about a 5% decline. We had about a 1% decline between 08 and 09, and we thought, oh, man, we reached bottom. That's great. Oh, no, turns out not. We're expecting another 5 to 7% decrease in consumption this year. You'll notice that our projections are that this is the bottom, and we're hoping to slowly recover from here, but we don't know that. And you'll also notice
is that revenue from consumption or is that consumption?
This is consumption, but then there's a little notation on here that shows you that over the last
That's
3 years, that was $16.5 million
that we were
expecting to receive in the utility that we didn't.
Okay, now I see
it. Is this total gallons or acre feet or what?
This is in gallons.
In gallons.
Yeah. Okay. So let me talk to you about fixed costs. And Mayor, you being a CPA, you'll notice right away that I accidentally included chemical, energy, and commodity under fixed costs, which I apologize for.
Mayor, just quickly, and back to that slide, you know, just from the 29,723 to the 26,742, you know, it was a drop of almost about 10%, right? So you think about what we just talked about, our increase in foreclosures. There's obviously a very tight relationship.
Yeah, no,
between
it's
what's
right when they started.
And what we're hoping is, and when you're going to see us when we talk about rates, that's what makes it difficult, because we try to, as Mayor said, we try to give at least a medium-term forecast where we think things are going, and it's difficult when continue to fall. And the forecast that you're going to see, the rate assumptions we make, we are assuming a very slight increase, or at least stabilization of accounts. But that can all change if some of those homes come back and we start getting those infills back into the foreclosures. We may come back next year, and I'm going to try to be more optimistic. Our future rate projections could be obviously modified if those mm-hmm. start filling up faster than we're projecting. Yeah, otherwise, sure. We're projecting pretty flat, refill of many of those foreclosed homes.
So obviously this utility, and we've talked about this utility has a lot of fixed costs. General fund transfer between the two utilities is about $52 million. Debt service in the water utility is going to jump about $9 million next year, about $20 million over the next 5 years.
Alex?
Yeah.
Along those lines on debt service, I know we've talked about it at a couple of different meetings. Do we have a plan to level out or restructure that debt for the future? I know there was some talk about that.
Yeah, we have that. We are looking at that. That's always something that we're looking at. That's not something we can do this year, but it's something that we'll be looking over in the next couple years for that. But I do want to show that this jump, when we say it's jumping to next year, it's not an unexpected, it's not an unplanned, it's not an unscheduled. This has been scheduled, this debt service has been scheduled this way for, 15, 20 years. We knew this was here. That's why we do 5-year, 8-year plans when we do rate analysis, to see what do we need to do to make sure that we are leveling our rate increases to the citizens while still maintaining the revenues we need to meet
this
our
is part of that evening out you talked about.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and based 5 years ago on where we projected our revenues to be and our fund balances to be, that was something that could easily be absorbed within this. Even if you kept your revenue steady, that meant that you are not eating into your fund balance, to your reserves.
Correct.
What we've had to do since the revenue's gone down is that we've had to we're talking about eating into our reserves,
correct.
Which mean that the projections for this debt service coverage are now out of whack.
Yeah.
Right.
And on the debt service as well, we are actually working toward all the new issuances of debt service will actually smooth out so that we maintain a smooth debt service schedule. We still have some debt service that was issued in past years that the way it was scheduled, we will have some years that are not as smooth as they could be. And so we're working on that with each new issuance to make sure that the debt service for each utility, water, wastewater, gas, and electric, are a smooth debt service for that program.
Well, and the other thing is that when you are in a capital-intensive business, and utilities are capital-intensive, you're going to have debt. You need to have debt. I mean, in some areas, I believe that we weren't using the marginal amount of debt, which creates an efficient operation.
Mm-hmm.
You need to replace old pipe. You need to stay above the curve, or else you're going to have breakage. You're going to have interruptions in service. And that's not something you can tolerate when you're providing life-giving services like water and electricity and wastewater. You just can't afford interruptions in service. And you cover that by incurring debt and front-loading your capital costs. Now, I do believe in looking at some of the comparison that we are very, very, on a comparative basis, we're not a heavily indebted city, and we're not a heavily indebted utility operation either.
That's right.
I mean, if you look at the legal limits as it relates to our even our revenue bonds and even our secondary property tax, we're well below adjoining communities, and we're well below the state imposed limits that we could have. So this is not an operation that is overly burdened by debt.
No.
When comparing all the industry averages and everything. Now, I'm making that assumption. You're shaking
your head. No, you're
right. I am.
That's correct. So we need to put it in context.
We compare very favorably. Again, here in the Valley, we couldn't find anyone who was lower than us in terms of debt service and cash capital, and we were 30% lower than anyone we could find.
Your first slides.
So we're very conservative that way.
Okay. So this is almost like the perfect storm for us, though,
as it
relates to our cash flow.
Right. It's the worst timing is that just as we are kind of rising to the plateau of our highest debt services, where we're having the greatest challenge as far as the consumption.
That's driven by the economy.
Right. So that's and in the past we have been building up. That's why we had fairly significant fund balances in the utilities leading up to this, because we saw this coming.
And so we had a rainy day.
We are building those in there, and that's why you see that dramatic decrease now. What's happened is it's been much more dramatic because of the loss of the consumption. So it puts a lot more pressure on us and the rates that we see going out into the future. This will level off for a period of time after 15-16. Then it probably levels down a little bit. But we're getting to the level of what we think will be the debt service that hopefully that we can maintain going out to the future. At some point, Mesa will reach a point where we've developed out the infrastructure for the entire area that we need to serve. And then we go back into a kind of rehab and replacement program is what we'll be doing mostly after that.
But unfortunately, on present course, our goal of maintaining our ending fund balance at 8 to 10% of total costs is not going to be obtained. This slide kind of shows you the same picture, but in a slightly different manner. This is an estimation of costs of the water utility per residential account. And you'll notice that direct costs are basically holding steady, but increasing a little bit as the cost of electricity and commodities and other things increases. The general fund transfer, of course, by policy is held steady. That's not increasing. As Chris mentioned, debt service is increasing. But to me, the most interesting thing about this slide is that you can see that our average water customer uses about 10,000 gallons a month and pays about $36 a month. This amount doesn't cover direct costs and debt service combined, let alone the general fund transfer. And this illustrates the point that I was trying to make earlier, that while our debt service and general fund transfers are fixed, revenues are highly dependent on consumption. And it's a good model, but...
Is that average a mean or a medium?
It's the mean. The mean, yeah. Okay. And here again, you'll see our projection on present course of what happens to our ending fund balance. And this is a combined ending fund balance between water and wastewater. I mentioned to you earlier we would combine them to help mitigate some of the problems. But even still, we drop too low. And unfortunately, because water and wastewater are the biggest enterprises that make the most money, when the ending fund balance of these utilities falters, it puts the ending fund balance of the entire enterprise program at risk. So, what are you going to do? I've talked to you a lot about how we're reducing costs. I've talked to you about how we're vetting and continually reevaluating the capital projects. I'm like the bad news bear that shows up to all of our staff meetings and talks about innovation, trimming costs, finding efficiencies. I got to give my staff credit, though, because they have managed to save $6 million this fiscal year, and that's incredible. They've really risen to the challenge. So the other thing that we wanted to talk to you about is the restructuring of our rates in a way that might mitigate some of the risk that we currently face when consumption falls. And of course, the way to do that is to shift from high dependency on revenues collected via consumption to a more balanced collection of revenues from fixed costs. No one wants to see fixed costs increase. I get that. To make it more palatable, we thought about including a small amount of consumption with the increases in the fixed costs so that people feel that they're kind of getting something for those increases in the fixed costs. And I also understand that it's very difficult to find that right balance between dependency on consumption and realizing more revenues from fixed charges. Obviously, it's my job to analyze and propose, and it's your job to represent the citizens and decide. And you'll see in here, I'll get to these options. You'll see in here an option where we just say, okay, forget it. Let's not restructure the rates. Let's continue the dependency on consumption. And we can do that. And if consumption rebounds, it's going to be a brilliant decision. But unfortunately, if it doesn't rebound, then we potentially worsen the problem. But before I get to that, let me just talk to you real quickly about our furlough program, because this is kind of hopefully easy. We do have a furlough program in the wastewater and solid waste programs. It's basically a program where you can sign up, you fill out a form, and you say, hey, I'm not here year-round, so when I'm not here, don't give me a break on my fixed charges. Well, obviously, it flies in the face of what we're trying to accomplish here. But so we would like to get rid of this program. But also, it's an honor system program. We don't have the staff to go out and enforce it and make sure that everything's, you know, that people are really not here. And we did do a cursory audit of the furlough accounts, and 85% of them, the vast majority, are showing activity year-round. We also took a look at other Valley municipalities to see, okay, well, who else might be doing this? And I think the answer was almost no one. Is that right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Okay.
Next item.
Sorry. Okay. So this is the rate restructure that we proposed to the Audit and Finance Committee. It's basically a minimum charge based on the first 5,000 gallons of consumption and water rate increases of 6.5% this year and 6% for the next couple of years. For the average customer, because they consume 10,000 gallons, really all they see is the rate increase of 6.5%. Something similar on wastewater, 4,000 gallons would be included in the minimum charge, and wastewater increases of 5% over the next couple of years. We understood from the get-go, we get it, that this would cause concerns for our permanent low-income residents who might use less than 5,000 gallons a month, and that's why we proposed, along with this program, the city's first-ever affordability program so we could set up and help these people with their utility bills if it's a problem. If we go forward with this proposal, we do meet our goal of maintaining our ending fund balance at 8%. The second option, I mentioned this, I kind of gave you a glimpse of it earlier, would be, okay, forget rate restructuring. Let's just increase our rates that much more to get the revenue. And we can do that. We think to do that, you're going to have to go at least 7.5% over the next couple of years and 6.5% in wastewater over the next couple of years. It does continue the reliance on consumption. And again, that's a good bet if consumption increases. Then we can all declare victory and go home. The third option that we would like, then this is a new one that the Finance and Audit Committee did not see. Yeah.
If consumption increases, we actually will be able to reduce rates.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So
I'm sorry,
if something goes up, we'll not be asking.
Well, yeah,
for
and let's.
Increase. I'm sorry, I thought that's what I said.
Yeah.
I must have missed
Dave.
It.
Yeah. Look at the slide back to slide 15, where it has cost per residential account, and then you have your three options that I know you're halfway through. It just seems to me that really there should be a charge associated with the maintenance of the system, a system fee or some kind. Instead of doing this minimum charge on the water, let people pay for the water they use.
Mm-hmm.
And because you get into 3,000 gallon, any minimum charge, you're going to wipe out any conservation that people want to do mm-hmm. between 0 and 3,000 gallons.
Mm-hmm.
Really, we should have a two-tiered rate structure. One's associated with the debt and infrastructure costs, and the other is associated with the water consumption.
Mm-hmm. So you mean increase the minimum charge but not include a certain amount of consumption with it?
Well, yeah. The consumption of the water should be, you know, if they use zero, they don't necessarily pay for water.
Mm-hmm.
If they use 10,000 gallons, they pay for 10,000 gallons. They mm-hmm. pay for what they use. Probably should consider step charges for high users, but I mean, we should really be looking at the debt associated with it and the infrastructure associated with it and have that cost captured in a fixed way. And then mm-hmm. that way people, if they can, the more they conserve, the more they save.
Mm-hmm.
And let's go on to the last option, because I think if you define a usage, you might be accomplishing the same thing, maybe in a different way. But go ahead.
Yeah.
Look at option three.
Yeah. Option three would be that we would have a minimum charge based on the first 3,000 gallons of water consumption. Because you're moving from 5 to 3, we would have to increase rates a little bit higher than the
Why did you come up with the 3,000-gallon number?
Well, you know, there's a certain level of water consumption that you need just to maintain a standard of living.
And that's determined by...
Well, there's all sorts of measures across the country, but there are pretty standard ideas of what a family or a household uses inside the home. Now, outside the home
is
very...
We've compared that to actual experience.
Catherine, we've actually gone and looked at where there's one individual living in the home and looked at what their average consumption might be over a period of time. And the 3,000 gallons, and it seems to be kind of a national average.
Well, and I also look at, you know, on Monday we had Marilyn here.
Yeah.
A single female in a house, and she said she uses 3,000 gallons a month. Not that we based it on that, but that sort of confirms.
We were already, yeah.
That sort of confirmed, right. That's an anecdotal confirmation
right.
of it, what we are assuming. 5,000, you're getting above, because you have a lot of people who don't use 5,000 gallons.
Right.
I mean, you know, I looked at my own water bill after that because I wasn't in audit finance. I went home and looked at mine. I'm not a lot above 5,000 gallons. And I got to figure there's a lot of families and a lot of especially single people that aren't using 5,000 gallons. You go to 3,000 and it seems like based on our records, looking at it, and then we have some anecdotal, that is
right.
probably a benchmark.
So, Mayor and Council, we have today, if you, maybe going to Councilor Richens' point, today, every account, regardless of consumption, pays
$12.11.
Yeah.
And then from there, there is the consumption rate that is used. We're trying to balance out the concern about people just using water for the sake of using water. But we decided that it would be best to benchmark our minimum rate against that, what we consider kind of that life, the minimum you would use if you were just one person living in a home. And that's where we got to 3,000. So what we're proposing here is that whatever that rate is becomes the new minimum. And from that point forward, then there is the rate applies against the variable consumption. And every year, then, we will base the minimum rate on what we will benchmark it against that 3,000 per gallon usage. That will become the new minimum. So if you use 3,000 or less, you'll pay that first.
And your thought process is that virtually nobody is using less than 3,000, so you've eliminated the disincentive.
When you go look at our accounts of usage between 3,000 and zero, it is pretty nominal.
It's really tough to use less than 3,000 gallons.
I would rather have the charges reflect the infrastructure costs of the system. If it's $12, $25, $50, we need to capture that real cost. And the furlough problem you described earlier goes completely away if somebody doesn't use a drop of water.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an issue. But they still have to pay for the pipe serving that house.
Yeah.
That does not ever go away. And the debt associated
Councilman,
to upgrade that stuff.
You are where we were from the very beginning. Here's the challenge is from an economic standpoint. And this shows you the kind of the disproportionality.
In this valley, we don't reflect the full cost of what it costs to bring water here. Time we start doing that.
Let me give you the dilemma that we were faced with. If you just took debt service and the general fund transfer, you're talking about at least at a minimum, if you just said that is our flat rate, everybody's going to pay for that, you're close to $45-$50 as starting point, as the base fee that everybody would pay, and then you would have some rate increase above that. Today, our average customer who uses 10,000 gallons a month pays only $36. So they're not even covering the public safety transfer
and the debt
service. So we could do that. Then you talk about the 3,000 gallon single person in the home who today is paying about
$20.67. Yeah.
We were just very concerned. And maybe that's a goal we work towards.
I mean, but we need to get real about what it costs to deliver water to people.
We are with you.
We're with you.
We were just trying to figure out.
So when are we going to bite?
This is our first approach. Approach is this, philosophically, and maybe the foreclosure option really brought it home to us because it was interesting, and Jack and I are in both these meetings. We're in one meeting where Solid Waste comes in and says, you know, garbage tonnage that we're picking up is dropping, but you know what? We're still doing okay because we have a flat rate structure. If you have an account with the city, you're still paying, whether you put out half a barrel or a full barrel, you're paying the same amount because it costs that truck pretty much the same in the landfill cost or the cost for capital to come there.
Right.
Then we come and we look at utilities, same number of accounts practically, actually a slight increase, but because consumption has dropped and the rate structure is so dependent on consumption. And to your point, it does not recognize. There's no doubt that the average utility customer does not pay for the direct cost, you know, whether it's the capital cost, which is reflected in the debt service, or whether it's the general fund public safety transfer. And so we are trying to figure out a way in our structure. It would help tremendously to begin to stabilize our structure by increasing that minimum today. And then in the future, maybe we can look at being more. But we're concerned about impacting that the lowest in, you know, those who use the less sometimes are the lowest income. And so we're trying to be very careful and sensitive to that. The proposal at the 3,000-gallon really helps us, going from essentially if you're a user with no activity in your account today, you're paying $12.60 under the 6.5% rate increase. Under this proposal, you'll be paying closer to the $20, but you'll be closer to what the 3,000 person, and you're paying more of that direct cost. And so the banks that are holding these homes in foreclosure, the out-of-state investors who are holding these homes for rentals, will now be paying more of the true cost for us to provide for public safety services when that home is still vacant. And as the council was talking about, the code compliance, the neighborhood services, it's getting us much closer than when we are today. And that's what this structure begins to do. And that's where we're trying to balance that out. We got great feedback from the Audit and Finance Committee about the concern. We went at 5,000 and benchmarking that. I think they brought some really good points that the way that impacted probably didn't make sense. But at the 3,000, I think we feel like we're beginning to move in that direction that you're talking about and establishing what is the actual cost, the true cost of providing services. Now, we still have ways to go.
Right. I mean, it's not cheaper to provide service to a low-income resident than it is to a high-income resident.
Or even to, correct. Even if you're not using, if you're not turning on the spigot, we have already invested a significant amount of cost, which is now being reflected in the debt service. We're so far ahead of everybody in what we've already paid to deliver those services, and now we're trying to recover that back.
So. But on the other hand, we have to balance. We set up this system. We've been billing. It would be inherently, I don't want to use the word unfair, but in a sense there's a fairness, to completely change a system that created a financial shock to those that remain in the system.
Correct.
Especially on the lower end.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to balance that. I agree that we need to get to the thing, to the point where our basic system is being covered by those who use it. And we have a unique situation here in Mesa because we have a lot of part year. We have a lot of foreclosures. We have businesses that really pay nothing to the city of Mesa, large bit. None of our businesses pay taxes to the city of Mesa because they don't pay sales tax. They don't do things. And this is our only connection with these business entities and their real estate, which receive massive amounts of city services, whether it be public services. I mean, we still got to have a fire station when there's a business there. We still have to provide police service 12 months out of the year, and we have no connection to them other than really our water and sewer.
And this,
at the end of the day,
it's the choice that city forefathers made instead of a property tax. You pay this way or you pay a property tax.
But
it's your choice.
Right.
You still have to.
It's a great point.
And in a situation where we have consumption that is consistent or linear in its increases, or where we don't have these aberrations in the market, that works fine. But the problem is it's still a market-driven. Mm-hmm. The services are not market-driven, as Councilmember Fenter mentioned. Services are not market-driven. They're fixed costs for the city, whether it be the pipes, whether it be the treatment, or whether it be the public service safety that goes with these. Those are fixed costs. And yet we have a revenue stream, much like sales tax, that is driven by the economy.
Mm-hmm.
I think the more we move away from that in a way that's fair and in a way that recognizes that you can't all of a sudden change the system midstream and expect that not to have a disproportionate impact on your lower use, lower income, many of which, most of right. which, are your single, retired, mm-hmm. fixed income type people. You've got to take that into account.
Absolutely, and it's certainly not our intent to impose an economic hardship on them.
Well, and I think what you've come up with is something where you're saying, just to reiterate, those people would not be impacted.
Right.
And that's where if I'm understanding you correctly, yes. that's where you came up with the 3,000.
Yeah.
Is that you look at the Marilyn Winterstoms,
mm-hmm.
who, and this is based just on what she told us, and you're saying, Marilyn, your bill next year isn't going to go up.
Mm-hmm.
But you look at somebody, the bank, who still has the water hookup, still has the sewer hookup. You look at the resident that isn't here
mm-hmm.
year-round, but we still protect their house year-round, and we still provide services year-round. Yeah, your costs are going to go up because there is a fixed cost of providing the hookup.
Correct.
Providing the station, of providing the police officer. Those things exist, and we need to get those more in line.
Absolutely.
That's what I'm hearing.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mayor. And again, we can go the extra step as well and institute the affordability program and make sure, okay, if we're inadvertently causing a hardship on someone, even at the 3,000 level, we don't think we are. We think that, you know, it's very difficult to use less than 3,000 gallons and still maintain, you know, a certain standard of living. But, you know, we can have the affordability program and institute that and make sure that we're not disadvantaging someone who shouldn't be.
I mean, you often talk about setting the policy for the whole and not for the exception. You know, if we're going to set this to be sensitive to the low-income and winter visitor resident, you know, we need to make a policy that works for the whole city, not for the exception. And if there are people that have a hardship paying their utility bill, that's why we have the ABC fund, and maybe we want to put more money towards that or to the agencies that help people. So when they do fall through the cracks, there is a safety net there for those. Right. But the system, that the rate structure we set up, better reflects the costs of getting the right. water to their tap.
And Councilman, you're right on point.
Yes.
And that's what we're trying to work towards. And I think our first step is, that's why we would propose now option 3 to be considered, because that goes a much further along to reach more of that goal that says, we believe then that many of the homes that are active, accounts that are still there but are not using consumption but are still relying upon public safety services, and we've invested the capital to provide those services when they need to turn it on at some point in the future, we'll be covering much more of that fixed cost under the proposal under option 3, but also not having a dramatic impact. You know, nobody will be impacted. Everybody will be impacted equally after that. Now, there is another option that we could go down, is where you just have a flat fee number that everybody pays in addition to your percentage rate increase. We didn't want to go there this year. We weren't comfortable enough that we had really vetted that through. Maybe that's something we can talk about in the future. But we think that option 3 goes a long ways towards helping stabilize quite a bit of our rate structure, so it's not so much dependent on the consumption, and we move that minimum no use charge from $12 to a little over $20. We think goes a long ways in helping us get there.
So you don't view this as an end all. We're going to reevaluate.
I think we need to come back
and look at it next year and see where we are.
Exactly.
As you can see from our charts, our consumption patterns, it's hard to do long term forecasting right now until we kind of see.
Well, until the economy improves and we get into a more normal
scenario. And what I'd like to see is maybe we move that base rate up a little bit more over years, and that maybe consumption comes back and these numbers we're showing you hopefully can fall, you know, decrease a little bit. We're only giving you a forecasted estimate. We know at least for next year we need, if nothing changed, consumption remained the same for the next 4 or 5 years, we need these rate increases to maintain our fund balances and meet our debt service obligation. Our hope is that we're being very conservative on our forecast of what, you know, the infill will be, and we hope it's much better than we're expecting, and we can then come back. We only collect what we need. We're not, because if we collect more in utilities, we don't transfer more to the general fund. We only collect what we need, and I want to make that very clear. We're only trying to collect in these rates exactly what we need.
And we're not talking about increasing the transfer.
No,
we're
no.
just
that's
talking about
saying.
Meeting
no.
the long-term fixed amount that we've determined years ago. So this is not about revenue recovery on the general fund.
Right.
This is about maintaining the basic needs of the water and the wastewater system.
And the fund balance.
And the fund balance, which is caused primarily by
that unusual aberration, that unusual situation, primarily the foreclosures.
Correct. And I don't want to get anybody get the impression that I'm insensitive to that. I am a water user and Mesa, City of Mesa ratepayer with four water-loving children. I can't tell you how many times I've come home with the hose running in the backyard. So, I mean, I know it would cost me out of my own pocket more, but for the system, I'd rather make sure that the system functions and continues to deliver that to my water-loving
Fair
children.
Enough. Option three would be a big step in getting us there, and then I think as we come back next year, we can talk more about how we can address that.
Okay. Alex?
And then I know we've beat this up enough, but questions for the future on the high end. Say the 20,000-gallon mm-hmm. month, folks. We have a tiered system currently. It was part of our water conservation.
We do.
The question I would ask is if we have such a lower consumption rate, maybe we're achieving the water conservation, and we shouldn't put a disincentive on the top side for folks. And I don't know. Maybe that needs to be hashed
out. Let's look at that.
We will look at that. Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, the next item is to hear a presentation on the Energy Resources Department budget.
That was bad news. This is good news.
As a matter of fact, while you're setting up, maybe if we can take 4 minutes.
Sure.
Let's take a little break. We've been here an hour and a half, so we'll be back in about, five after, okay? Okay.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Good morning, Mayor and Council. I'm Frank McRae with the Energy Resources Department. That's the city's electric and gas utilities. And on your right is Mike Comstock, our Deputy Director. First slide is just a graphic that shows how our goals and objectives of safety, reliability, and efficiency correlate with the City Council's strategic objectives. One aspect of this is our emergency planning and response times. We've done a lot of work to manage how we respond to our customers' requests for emergency assistance, and our response times have declined over the course of the last several years. This provides financial stability to the city in terms of it lowers our overtime cost, lowers our personnel cost, less time spent on the road responding to calls, lowers our vehicle costs. Blue Stake over 105,000 utility locates a year. That's across 10 utilities for the city. With our accuracy record, we're three times more accurate than the national standard for underground locations. One other point I wanted to make is we coordinated with three other departments within the city to install some IVITA security systems at one of our substations. This is a substation that had historically seen copper thefts, break-ins. It's also an area that had seen quite a bit of suspicious criminal activity, graffiti. We've located those cameras. We can also watch a water well adjacent to the substation. We can watch the railroad tracks across the street from the substation, and we can watch the neighborhood and share those video images and monitoring surveillance reports with the police department, fire department, transportation, streets, etc. This is a local company, and with the demonstration that we've used at this substation, IVITA has gotten quite a bit of national press and the trade media outlets for this project.
And what's been the outcome?
Have
the graffiti decreased? Has the copper theft?
We have not had a graffiti incident on the walls of the substation since October. We've not had one instance of a break-in or copper theft since then. We have had two instances of suspicious activity on the perimeter of the substation back in October, November, and after police were summoned to investigate the scene, we've not had any further reports of any suspicious activity around the substation.
Want to tell, of course, tonight, now that you've, you've jinxed it.
Yeah. We'll have armed security.
Mike's going to be cruising around the substation tonight.
Oh, okay.
we'll send Carl Jr.'s for you. Public safety of our system is very, very important to us, both to the public and our customers. One thing that we've accomplished is over 1,000 days of no lost time accidents on the electric side, and we had an accident in October of last year, but up until that time we had 738 days of lost time accidents. To kind of put it into perspective, In 2009, there was only seven utilities of our size that went just in 2009 without a lost time accident. So I don't have a way yet of finding out how many utilities our size have continued to have no lost time accidents since then, but just in 2009, we were one of seven.
And that's kind of one of those savings that we don't see here, because all those worker comp claims that we're not having to pay out is significant.
The obvious benefits are, one, the safety and health of our employees, having a complete crew working continuously, that keeps productivity up. Having complete crews really makes us go through our operations maintenance, corrective maintenance programs more efficiently.
Councilman Finter?
And also, if you look at what goes on nationwide with some of the different terrible things that happen in California back east, we have a stellar safety record on the gas company and others, and just an outstanding bit of service, and really appreciate all that's done, and knock on wood for that one too, but thank you.
We do have I think, an incredible record on the safety of our gas system. Our track record in underground locating is symbolic of the care and the professionalism of our folks in the gas utility, and we have a stellar record. It's a very heavily regulated part of our business, and we've done amazing things in both exceeding expectations for the regulations and maintaining a cost control as well. Our department structure is here. I think this correlates very closely to our prioritization of safety, reliability, and the efficiency with which we do things, and then that also correlates with the council's strategic initiatives. Don't want to spend too much time here, but over the course of 10 years, you can see that on the electric side, we've cut our staff in half. On the gas side, we've added about 10% positions, but we've also increased our customer counts by about 45%. Our total energy staff has gone down by about 16%. Over the course of these 10 years, we've eliminated two of our senior management positions, so that's almost a 30% reduction in our upper management staff. We also have one vacancy right now due to a retirement, and that's under review to figure out whether we can pursue our operations with not having to fill that position. A little bit of statistics on our system. We've got about 15,000 electric customers in the 5.5 square miles, and we've got about 55,000 gas customers both in the city of Mesa and in Magma. Here's our financial overview, and to beat the mayor to the punch on the net income issue, the income before the transfer in actuality was about $7.87 million in 09-10, so after the general fund transfer, it was about $1.87 million. Adopted budget, we think we're going to come in very close to the forecast in 10-11. Our projected net income before the general fund transfer will be about $9.1 million.
Wait. Help me understand the second bullet point on that financial, on this financial purchase power 11-12 budget for commodities. What is you look up at the commodity line? It's 18.2, and down there you say 17.8. What is? Help me understand those.
If you look at the commodities line, those are primarily comprised of our energy supply costs. So, of the $18.2 million of commodities, 17.9 of that is our energy supply costs. So the other commodities are consumable type products.
Okay.
So our energy supply costs, including our transmission contracts to deliver power from the sources to our loads, is included in that $17.9 million.
And we do not generate any power. We always buy off the open market.
We divested ourselves of our generation assets about 2 or 3 years ago. So since that time, we've been buying completely off the market. Those generation resources supplied minimal amounts of our energy supply when we own them. And for this fiscal year, we're not proposing any general rate increases on the electric utility. This is a slide that just
another quick question. How many total megawatts?
I'm sorry?
How many total megawatts do we supply to our customers? What's our total purchase?
Our total annual energy requirements are about 320 million kilowatt hours a year. The average customer consumes about 1,000 kilowatt hours a month. Here's our pie chart for our utility revenue showing the mix of residential and commercial and other customers. With a residential customer base of this magnitude, we're very weather sensitive. So if we have an extremely hot summer, our customers' consumption will go up and our revenues will likely go up. Sometimes the cost increases on the commodities piece will also increase according to consumption. Sometimes there'll be a spike in the market price of energy. On the gas side, pretty similar story. This year we're proposing about a 2.5% increase in our revenues. That generates about $528,000 additional per year. If you add up the increases in costs under our personal and other services and our debt service, that adds up to about $1.5 million. So the increase in revenues associated with the rate increase does not by itself keep up with the proposed increases in costs. Again, we're showing that the natural gas supply costs are about $16.9 million. Because of the rate mechanism we use to recover those costs aren't reflected in any of the revenues or costs above.
So the rate increases is outside of that. You have these cost adjustments and everything that are in there.
In this slide, you can see that on the gas utility, we're even more dependent upon the residential class of customers. We are seeing some significant increases in the commercial side. CMC Steel was a large customer added to the system, as well as some of the banner facilities. Our budget adjustments in fiscal year 2011-12 amount to about $250,000. We've also identified two pilot programs as a part of the Innovate or the Employee Idea Program. One is to take vehicles that are capable of using gasoline and compressed natural gas. Our fleet department has a compressed natural gas facility. We're looking to incent our employees to greatly enhance their use of compressed natural gas up to two-thirds of their total fuel consumption. With our 10 vehicles just in energy resources, that should equate very conservatively to about $7,500 a year in savings.
Councilman Richens.
How come we don't have a public CNG station for people to come fill up their cars?
That's a long story. I'll try and give you the short version of it. There are private enterprises that have installed CNG fueling stations, and one of our reluctancies to get into that business is when private enterprise is likely to be able to do something, we're going to try and let them enter into that endeavor first. We are in discussions with one of those entities to partner up with them so that we can perhaps co-locate a public fueling station with a fueling station that will also service City of Mesa vehicles.
Just a single one, or maybe one.
It could be more than one, but
yeah, because I've had inquiries from some large fleet users who would like to use more CNG, but their frustration is there aren't public CNG stations in Mesa. The closest one is, I can't remember where it is, maybe over on the. And there one over on the There used to be one right there at McKellips and Alma School. But I don't think it was a vehicle one. And then the other ones are over in Tempe or Phoenix.
Yeah, there aren't that many. Sky Harbor.
Sky Harbor, there you go.
In the past, when we've looked at it, the capital investment that's required to put in a standalone station is very high, and without having an assured market to be able to repay the capital, it's a little bit of a risky enterprise for us, so we've hesitated to do that and focused on the local distribution company.
With our
direction, we can explore it more aggressively.
I'm sorry. Our filling station is inside our gates.
It's
so there's no public
gates.
Access to it.
Right.
So what you're talking about maybe doing is moving maybe or doing a duplicate station or doing something where we can fill our vehicles. They'd be outside the gates and therefore, and it'd also have access to public.
So some kind of co-location. The transit facility up near 202 is starting to develop, I believe, a facility where the public can come in and use their equipment. So we'd like to partner with them. They're a gas customer of ours.
That's Greenfield, the Metro, the RPTA station.
Yes, sir. Okay. So we can partner with them, and we can also look at partnering with some of these private enterprises to see if that's an endeavor we want to pursue.
We should consider a request for proposals for, you know, see if somebody wants to come and partner with us to do some CNG stations.
Yeah. And we've discussed that with the private enterprises, and we've told them that as we're looking closer at enhancing the CNG fleet of the city or not, we'd be interested in exploring some opportunities to partner with them.
And you, I mean, you see that happen on the electric side, SRP and APS doing requests for proposals for solar generation, and you know, then they're the end user taking that off the system, and the capital is all on the private side, and then they just have the power purchase agreement that we're going to buy so many megawatts from you off that system. I mean,
that's good. Yeah,
we've got 20 acres over on the corner. Maybe we just cover it with solar panels over there. I don't know. Okay.
The next Innovate program was when we maintain, do maintenance or repair on a residential meter, we typically curtail service, interrupt service to that customer. We've found a device that allows us to continue the flow of gas to the customer so that we don't have to shut off service to the customer. When we shut off service to the customer, we like to go into the house, relight the pilot lights, do a very preliminary minor inspection of their facilities. By being able to continue service to the customer when we're performing these activities, we'll be able to save the return trips that's often required to come back and relight the pilot lights. There's often also times impacts to the customer's appliance when we have to terminate service, it cools down, and then when it heats back up, thermostats and thermocouples tend to fail, and so we're required to respond back out to those customers and help them with their appliance issues. So we think we're going to save at least $20,000 a year with just this one device and limiting its applications to where we've been within that household within the last 24 months. A couple of accomplishments. I'll be very quick on this. I've talked about employee safety and IVITA and our financial performance, but over the course of the last 3-4 years, we've been on a very, very intensive capital improvement program. We're going to be completing the 69 kV conversion from wooden poles to steel and concrete poles within about a year. Our 4 kV conversion is now at 88% complete, conversion from 4 kV to 12 kV. We'll have one more substation associated with that conversion project to complete. Vault lids, we've replaced. Find the number real quick.
Hey, Frank, I know you're looking at that. On those substation, my understanding was, and maybe I didn't understand it correctly, is that there would be some 4 kV substation decommissioned as you went to the more efficient one. Did I misunderstand that, or is that still?
No, that is correct, Mayor. We'll have probably 10 sites that we will no longer need for any electric utility operations, and we have started identifying the footprint of those, and we're starting to discussions with Parks and Recreation so we can see if we might reclaim those sites and use them for some kind of a parks facility. So okay. We've initiated that process. We just haven't made a whole lot of progress yet.
Okay.
We've replaced 49 underground.
Yes, any phase one environmental issues or with remediating those sites?
We haven't identified those yet.
Well, that'll be part of our due diligence.
They're definitely phase one. It's the phase two that.
Right. That's bad.
That could be bad.
We'll look at them all, because if there's a way to bring them into some kind of reuse, that's our goal.
Yeah.
Whether we have to mitigate the environmental or.
Do we have that captured in our budget stuff here too? Do all that environmental stuff.
Well, phase one and stuff. Well, not the remediation, because we have to figure out what it is. But some of the first phases of environmental, we can do that in-house.
That's the investigation.
Right.
Okay. All right.
We've replaced 49 underground vault lids. A lot of these are in heavy thoroughfare areas, sidewalks. So we've replaced those vault lids, which have greatly enhanced public safety, and we've replaced about 109 pad mount transformers. On the gas side, talked about a little bit about emergency response times and financial performance. Just want to point out the joint projects. These are projects with transportation, water, and sewer where we're pursuing replacement of aging infrastructure in joint projects with them to minimize the impact on the community. Even though we've had a reduced amount of new customer growth on our system, we still have what would be considered a healthy level of growth compared to utilities around the country. And one important project is to add a gate station to the southeast part of our system. That'll greatly enhance service and reliability to the eastern portion of our system. Challenges and opportunities. We're proud to be able to say that we've now achieved parity and equality with South Salt River Project's residential electric rates. We do have some challenges in the future with expiring contracts that we'll have to replace. We expect to pay a little bit higher price in those new contracts, but we've got a real good planning process that allows us to identify the opportunities to meet those resource requirements in a least cost manner. We're also initiated an enhanced partnership with economic development to focus on businesses that might be impacted by the light rail project and to provide some support to them through some type of means with their electric utility service.
Speaking of light rail, when they move into downtown and they have those stations down there, do they
become a customer?
They become a customer?
Yes, sir. We anticipate that there will be three power stations.
We like that.
Well, yes, although we do pay an annual maintenance fee for rail. So
no, I know that, but at least we're selling electricity
to
them.
Tell them the electricity charge is going to be full cost recovery, what it takes to operate light rail in Mesa.
The only thing I'm worried about is they'll just charge us right back for that same amount. So put in one pocket, take it out the other.
Come out even.
Yeah, sorry. Okay. But to this point, and I, you know, give credit to you, especially to Frank and their folks, Mike, thinking about this, is they want to be part of helping the businesses make it through that difficult time. So we're working with economic development, trying to structure an opportunity. So during that difficult time, the construction when business may not be like it is today, trying to figure out some way to provide some relief in the utilities during that on the electric side to help them out. So
over the course of recent history, there's been a lot of volatility in the natural gas industry in terms of supply and rates. We've seen that subside in the last couple of years. Natural gas prices now are about equal to what they were 5 years ago. There was a spike a couple years ago, but with the worldwide economy declining and the associated decline for demand for natural gas, there's a supply imbalance with natural gas, and prices have stabilized quite low. Environmental regulations are always a challenge for utilities. It's the case for gas and electric. We have a pretty good handle on what we anticipate those regulations to be. Because we're not in businesses such as the generation of electricity, we won't be subject to the risk of compliance cost with those rules, but our suppliers will be subject to those risks. So that's the way we'll manage those risks. And one of the things I'd also like to point out is, as we've managed our utility, we've looked for opportunities to outsource the things that are incumbent upon us to do. So we're purchasing generation resources. We're not managing and owning our own resources. We're purchasing people to manage our operations, dispatch, and control area services on the electric and gas side. We pay an outside entity to do those types of things. So where it's not our core competency, or where an outside entity can perform the service at a lower cost, more efficiently, more reliably than ourselves, we've been contracting for those services.
Wait, I think we did that without the legislature demanding that we do it?
Sometimes it happens, Mayor.
Golly.
Sometimes good management just happens.
Just happens. Huh? It's amazing. Thank you. Alex.
Back on gas rates, are we looking at a strategy to hedge these low gas rates, or what's our strategy on commodities purchases on them?
We've done a lot of work at trying to build a hedging practice, if you will, and it would require a lot more manpower than we currently have to do a good job at that. In reality, we've compared our gas supply costs to the cost of other gas purchasers in the region, and with our simple approach of just buying gas on a two or three year basis with index prices, our gas supply costs seem to be marginally lower than any of the other neighboring utilities. So Until we start paying too high of a price for that gas over an extended period of time, I'm hesitant to put much effort into the hedging activities. Talked a little bit about our residential bill comparisons. We're now a whopping $2.84 less per year than SRP on the residential bill, with an average monthly usage of $8.64. $2.84 less per month, or less per year, excuse me. For our comparison with Southwest Gas, we've historically been lower than Southwest Gas. We maintain that position. We're about $26, almost $27 per year less than Southwest Gas in the city of Mesa service area. That value includes with the proposed 2.5% rate increase that's for fiscal year 11-12.
And we're working toward shrinking that gap over the years, correct?
What?
I think that's something we brought out last year.
I think we did on Magma.
On Magma.
Yeah, the cash cow.
Already less.
Yeah.
Here.
Well, I know we're less. I mean, the idea was
Magma, we're getting closer, but there were some, yes.
Yeah, no, I think the idea was the difference. The gap was significant. And the whole idea is to have our rates both on the SRP side and on the Southwest Gas be as comparable as we can while keeping them below them, but not to have huge gaps either way.
Right.
I mean, you'd like somebody on one side of the street and the other side of the street that have comparable usage amounts to be as close to a situation as we can. I know there are differences. You know, we have we have cost differences and whatever you call those. My brain's not functioning very well this morning. Cost, fuel adjusters and things like that, commodity charges. But the idea is to shrink that difference so that they can be about on the same plane as we can. And in Southwest Gas, where we're substantially below that, I don't think it's wrong to work those up to where they're about in the same ballpark.
Okay.
I'm not a natural gas customer, but this follows the same principle as the discussion on water rates. I don't know how our rates are necessarily structured on the bill because I don't get one. You know, do we have the core fee and then the commodity charge on top of that? Or how do we structure the gas rates?
We have a fixed monthly customer charge that is designed to recover the cost of metering, billing, customer service. The other fixed cost of the system, the pipes and the valves, those are recovered through consumption-based charges. Our gas supply costs, meaning the interstate transportation and the actual acquisition, purchasing of the commodities, is recovered through what's called a purchased natural gas cost adjustment factor. And that is adjusted monthly so that we are not over or undering recover those costs by a significant amount in any fiscal year.
So we have like a three-tier.
It's three distinct components.
Okay.
The customer charge, which is fixed per month, the consumption charge, which is based upon their monthly billed consumption, and then the gas adjustment factor, which is also based upon their monthly gas adjustment.
Okay.
We don't have quite the level of fixed cost ratio to total cost ratio that water or wastewater utilities have. A lot of our costs in the gas side and electric side, it's about $19 million of our total cost structure, is energy supply costs, and we have mechanisms that automatically adjust the rate so that we don't over or under recover by substantive amounts.
Got it. Okay.
in those cost factors. So when consumption goes up or down for the gas and electric utilities, it doesn't have the financial consequences for us as it would for water.
Well, your delivery system is not nearly as complex as a water delivery system. You don't treat it. You don't have to pump it.
But his commodity price fluctuates.
Your commodity price fluctuates.
Whereas water's,
yeah.
So it's a kind of a different
But
dynamic.
You also have your price adjuster.
Right, no,
there,
no, that's what I'm saying, yeah. So we just don't
that.
Have, exactly.
Yeah, so it's a very different system. Even though there's pipes involved and it's pressured, it's a very different system.
He distributes it.
Correct. On the electric side, the equivalent of a water treatment plant is a generation plant.
Right.
And we don't own generation plants. We buy it on the market.
So that cost is included in the cost of purchasing.
Right. It's in the cost adjustment factor. So those costs are recovered through that mechanism, and it's a pass-through. So we don't have quite the consequences for our financial health when our consumption goes down as it would for water.
Right.
It's things we need to keep thinking about. You know, we kind of look between solid waste and the electric and see how that might apply to water at some point, too. So,
okay.
That concludes our presentation, and we'd be happy to try and answer any questions you might have.
Great. Any questions? Councilmember Glover.
Yeah, I know. I'm 3,000 miles away, and I actually opened my mouth. I know it's a surprise for everybody. But I have just a quick question for Frank. Is there a possibility for the electric utility to set aside some money for underground power lines in the future?
We're going to look into that as a part of our staff IMESA program. To see what that would cost, how we would prioritize, where we might invest those costs, get a real good handle on where those costs might end up and how we could possibly fund them over time.
Okay, the only reason why I ask is that I know that in my district, Councilmember Richens' district and Councilmember Kavanaugh's district, we see a lot of the power lines, and that's kind of like your sky view from when you're a pedestrian walking down the street, and I would like to try to get prettier view for residents and for tourists when they come to Mesa. That's only my two cents.
We're going to explore that, and again, it'll be one of our staff IMESA projects to pursue and see how blue a sky we can make for the neighborhoods.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Councilman Finter.
And the only other thing that's come through the council office, and I think Mr. Richens has heard about it too, is looking at solar opportunities for the electric in those pocket parks or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that may come, I think that's coming through IMESA also, and just kind of be able to see what's that about.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, and a lot of those, I think we can be on the forefront. You know, I think there's a lot of symbolism that goes with some of the our exploration of alternative energy sources. I mean, it's interesting with the first solar, the number of questions and the amount of discussion that comes up as it relates to solar. The reality is solar will never completely replace traditional energy. I mean, that's and a lot of people, I think, have jumped to the conclusion some are trying to replace what we get now. No, it's a component. It's part of a, just like transportation, a multimodal energy source. And certainly we get electric from hydroelectric and from nuclear. We don't get any nuclear probably, but others do. Coal-driven, coal-powered. There's a lot of different ways to get electrical, that electricity is generated, and that we get it from. Solar's just in the mix. Wind is just in the mix. And it's all these things will add up to having a complete inventory of sources. But I think that as we look in Arizona, certainly in becoming a solar leader, there are ways we can get in the game that are visible that may not totally solve all the problems, but they certainly show us as a leader. So we can do that, and that will lead to more investment and more type of things. I'd be all for that.
Our current portfolio has about 20% of our annual energy requirements met by renewable hydro on the Colorado River, but we're looking to supplement that with whether it's wind or geothermal or solar. The concept of a community solar garden, kind of what SRP's project, we've been floating that idea for a couple of years now, and so we're still exploring how we might want to implement it, what's the costs are, and how do we ask our customers or our community more in a more broad manner to fund that type of a facility.
Great. Thank you.
Good. Thanks.
Okay. All right. The next item is the here presentation on the proposed major general plan amendment for 262 acres on the northwest corner of Signal Butte and Elliott Roads.
Mayor and Council, good morning. Going to introduce to you Angelica Guevara, senior planner in our staff who's handling this case, so I'm going to let her actually make the presentation. But this is the time of year when we can receive major general plan amendments, and we did receive one this year, and this is an opportunity for Council to give some early input to the applicant on this. So, Angelica, I'll let you describe the case.
Thank you, and good morning. The applicant is here, or Ralph Pugh representing the applicant, because we did receive a request, as John indicated. These requests do take about a year long to process. I've got a little bit of a timeline here. We received the request earlier this month, but we did start working with the applicant early in the year. The applicant did receive some feedback from the Planning and Zoning Board members yesterday at the hearing, and he's here today to get feedback from the council members in order to prepare a follow-up submittal prior to May 10th. After that, we'll be starting a 60-day review period, which will last through the summer, of which then would be followed by two planning and zoning board hearings. And then we're anticipating that the earliest council public hearing would be in October or possibly November. The request is to amend 262 acres located north and west of Signal Butte and Elliott Roads. The request is to change the land use from business park to medium density residential, 4 to 6 units per acre. And the basic impact of this request is to reduce the amount of land designated for employment uses and to increase the amount designated for single residence use. The applicant has provided a land use comparison, of which I have it up on the PowerPoint. It shows the existing general plan land use designation on the left. It shows the color light purple, which is the business park land use designation that exists on the 262 acres. On the right-hand side, you can see the proposed land use map, which indicates a change, as the applicant is requesting, to the 262 acres to the medium density residential. You'll notice that there's a slight color change or color that remains in that light purple at the bottom corner of the site. I have the conceptual community master plan up on the screen now, which the applicant has also provided. This is conceptual, and the specific request that would be considered is to amend the general plan from the business park to the medium density residential. Nothing in that specific request or approval of that land use change would require the applicant to develop this specific proposal. If the general plan amendment was approved, the applicant would then have to come back with another application for rezoning and site plan review, of which at this time the applicant has provided this conceptual community master plan showing an intent on how they would develop that. The overall project consists of about 314 acres, of which the 52 acres at the immediate corner of Signal Butte and Elliott would be retained as business park. So the purpose of us being here today and the applicant being here is to allow council members to provide the applicant any initial comments or feedback that you have. Because of the year-long process and some of the state statutes that we're working with, the applicant has limited ability to make changes throughout the review process of this request. So they are here today to receive any feedback so that they can go back and make any changes if they feel any are needed. And then make a final submittal. So at this time, staff has not developed any type of a recommendation, and we really have not made any type of an analysis either. Thank you.
Kind of feedback you want.
Mayor and Council. I don't know if we've had the chance to go through this process with this group before. It's been a couple of years since we've had a major plan amendment. As Angelica mentioned, the process, the way that it works, once we get to that 60-day review period and notice the world about this request, we really don't let the applicant make any modifications to what they've requested. So what we've experienced in the past is we get to the end of the process, and it finally gets to council, and council can say, well, if you would have done this way back at the start, you know, I might have had...
Then
this is your chance to
kind of give them... I've met with the applicant, not on this plan, but on other things. This property has a long history because of its location in the corridor south of the power lines and north of Elliott. Because of the entire gateway strategic plan. We set out to provide developers more flexibility in the area. That flexibility was hopefully intended to elevate the level of development, also to have the developers or put the onus on them to come in and show us why this was a benefit to the area, how it elevated the area. And they elevated it meant that it conformed with the overall economic and strategic plan of the Gateway area while not adversely affecting airport operations, which went hand in hand. I'm a little reluctant to go through general plans that don't have specifics. This is not a cotton field. This is not an area that is a normal process where we go through general plans and we don't have, and I get it that I've been in this business a while. This is a unique situation. I'm a little bit iffy about moving ahead with conceptual general plans that don't mean a thing once the color changes on the map. And then all of a sudden you're set with medium density 4 to 6 with a business park on the middle that somebody's going to come back in and want neighborhood commercial because there's no neighborhood commercial in the area. I don't know. I'm just reluctant to, at this stage in the game, to really support a general plan amendment in this place at this time for this reason. Councilman Fenter.
I had the opportunity to suffer through this whole process on planning and zoning board years ago, so familiar with it. I'm really concerned. I'm concerned about the flight paths, some of the development going on, some of the issues that have, so definitely concerned. You know, it's too much to bring up right now in a meeting, but serious concerns, I guess I would say.
I think there's no doubt that as we come out of this economic downturn, the pressure in this area is going to be to transition as much as we can into residential. Residential is what will sell first. Residential, and the owners of this property have tried for years to get residential on this property. I get it. And I'm not one that would, out of the starting block, say no to residential. But what we've said is that in the airport area, if we're going to err, it's going to be to err on the side of caution as it relates to residential. And I don't know enough about the 4 to 6, which is really a low density for, I think, a flight path type of development. And I don't know the particulars about the kind of community. That's a big community with 200-plus acres. Well, net-net, it comes out to I don't know how much in residential. But you said 267 for the entire site?
314 acres.
Oh, 314. So 206 was the 260 the residential component? It's
residential, yes. And their project narrative suggests approximately 1,300 dwelling units.
I was going to say, that's a big community. And, you know, the problem is that they're looking at the neighbors and seeing what developed north of the power lines, what developed out by Mountain and those things. And fair or unfair, that's not what we're looking for here because of the unique nature of the Gateway area. And I can't tell them what to develop because I don't really know, but they haven't told me what they really are going to develop other than 4 to 6 and a nice drawing that really doesn't mean a whole lot about anything. So I don't know what the natural progression is. I want to be fair to the landowner, but on the other hand, we need to be consistent and true to what this council enacted 2-plus years before, and frankly, what previous councils have gone through in this area. And we know that we're going to have some hard discussions on residential in the area. We know that this area historically has been reserved because of the flight path. We have much more information now than we did 3 years ago, because Allegiant wasn't flying 3 years ago in the way that they are flying now and the numbers they're flying now, and with the routes they're flying now. I mean, they really have only been flying this new procedure for a couple of years since they changed the Phoenix Class Bravo airspace and had them doing the hard right turn going out of Gateway and heading east. So I don't know. I think we need a lot more talk and a lot more upfront discussion as to really what's going to happen here and a vision for this particular piece. 1,400 units, that's 3,000 to 5,000 people, depending upon how this thing is popular. That's a big community. That's a town in and of itself. I would need a little bit more. No, I'd need a lot more details and a lot more information before moving forward. Councilman Richards.
I mean, I'm not sure if there was a mistake in some of the exhibits, but not very many of them loaded. I had a lot of white blank exhibits with just street names on them with no tables in them. And so I came to this meeting just kind of having a lot of incomplete information just because the exhibits in the presentations didn't load for some reason. I mean, it's a lot of this. I mean, did yours look like that too? Just white, blank. It has a bunch of street names, but no colored exhibits or anything like that on there.
This is in the
page report. Like page 29 has it, but see page 28. I mean, it's just yeah. So we're kind of.
Oh yeah, they didn't load. Councilman Finter.
And other questions would be, what's gone on at the FAA? There was talk at one time of shifting airspaces and things, and this has been years since then. It'd be nice to have that information. You know, they talked about running that exit corridor down the 60, but I know that there's been so much work on that. And I remember the dueling sound studies that came from different folks, and so it'd be nice to have some updates. And like the mayor brings up a great point, Allegiant, that's a whole different factor that was never considered before. So thanks.
Okay. I don't know if we just muddled the picture or we brought more clarity to it, but and Councilmember Summers isn't here either. That's a little unfair to go through this, and I'm assuming that they've met with him. This is his district.
I believe they have, Mayor, but we will follow up particularly with him and see if he has any comments. We
want to make sure. Let's do that, and then let's have some further conversations. And I'd like to touch base with him to see what his feedback is.
But I think the applicant's getting an idea that where the council is before they spend the next year going through a lot of effort. That's part of what's happening here, too.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
All righty. Thank you. Okay, here reports on meetings and conferences attended. Anything? I would just like to say one thing on Tuesday night. Yeah, Tuesday night. I had the opportunity to attend and address the Mountain View High School National Honor Society induction. And if you ever doubt whether there's good quality kids who do great things. You know, on Monday and Tuesday, we had a great example with having the Mountain View basketball team in on Monday, and the National Honor Society. You know, just great kids, and they're just an example. Every high school, every place in Mesa, we have good kids doing great things. And it two things I thought of. Number one, it gives me comfort to recognize that you know, you hear a lot on the news about all the bad stuff that's going on among the things that. That are troubled, and to know that there's a large number of kids in our community that are doing great things. The second thing is that it also, I couldn't help but think while I was there and talking about this land thing even, how many of those kids are going to come back to Mesa because they can fulfill their dreams. I mean, these are the cream of the crop. These are those that will go on to the great colleges and universities and you know, have the potential to do great things. You know, all our kids, I hope, do, but these ones are the small percentage that excel. And the question is, are they going to be able to find opportunities back in our community? And right now we'd have to say it's a mixed bag. So it also, you know, put the responsibility back on us to create an environment and do as much as we can so that private companies will come and invest here, so we'll get more First Solars, so that small business can thrive, so that we can create that kind of economy and that kind of environment. So that these kids won't go elsewhere. They'll come back and they'll help contribute to our community in the long run.
On Tuesday night, I had the opportunity to attend the Mesa Chamber Awards, which was a really cool event honoring a lot of Mesa businesses and people doing business in Mesa. One of the things they brought up is now in Mesa you have the opportunity to attend school from preschool to a PhD if you want. You can do all of that in Mesa. And so it kind of, I think, it bolstered your point. And they had several teachers and students they honored at that event as well. I thought it was really well done. But
I went to the first part of that, and I think it was the largest crowd they've had for that event. You could feel an energy that you haven't felt. There's a lot of good stuff going on in the community. There really is. And you could really feel an energy. And so there's things that are looking up, and they're positive things. And this Gateway area is just, you know, it's the centerpiece, but it's not the only place that we're having there. I mean, what was really good is at that chamber event, there was a whole table that was taken out by Crescent Crown. You know, and they're not even technically in the community yet, and yet they're now involved. they're contributing, they have their management there. And that's what happens when you bring good businesses that have headquarter type operations, which Crescent Crown is going to have, is now they're all of a sudden involved. And that creates opportunity. So there's great things going on. So thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, they also rolled out an initiative called Think Mesa. And they didn't give a ton of detail around it, but it had a cool logo and kind of fits in with all the different things that we're doing. So
good.
Welcome, brand.
Great. That's cool. Okay. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a reminder, there's a pancake breakfast this Saturday at Fire Station 212, which is Ellsworth in Guadalupe. So invite everybody there for a pancake breakfast from 8 to 10 a.m. And this Tuesday, April 26th, there is a Building Stronger Neighborhoods kickoff at Madison Elementary, which begins at 6:30 p.m. And our next study session will be Thursday, April 28th. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Glover, you have anything?
Nope. I move that we end the meeting.
We have a motion to adjourn. I have a second, Councilmember Fenter. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. You can hang up now. We're done. Thank you.
Appreciate it.